You will take your Bible to turn to Psalm 90. Psalm 90. If you look at Psalm 90, you look down at verse 12, please. Verse 12. We're getting right to the heart of what we're looking at this morning by looking at this verse. So teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. What does he mean by number our days? If I understand the context of the psalm, he means contemplate the brevity of human life. And as we consider and think about the brevity of human life, it ought to give us some degree of wisdom in how we view life. I know from back up in verse 3 through 6, he's talking about the brevity of human life. And he uses several analogies in that section of this psalm to talk about how brief human life is. He said, "You turn man back into dust and say, 'Return, O children of men.'" You recall back in Genesis when man sinned, the verdict was, "To dust you shall return." And thus he's talking about death, the end of human life. "For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by." When you think about the measure of a man's life, what is the longest possible human life that you could imagine? The longest one that we read about in the Bible is 969 years, the life of Methuselah. By saying 1,000 years, he raises it to a superlative. As long a life as you may want to consider, it is like yesterday. It's gone, but in a moment. Then he compares it to a watch in the night, verse 4, just a portion of a night. And then he compares it to a flood. "You have swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep. And then in the morning they are like grass which sprouts anew. In the morning it flourishes and sprouts anew. Toward evening it fades and withers away. Like a flower that exists for a day." You think about a man living 969 years or 1,000 years, it seems like a long, long time. But in perspective of God, it is nothing. It is indeed like yesterday, like a watch in the night, like a flood that sings away, or like a flower that exists for a day. Is that the contrast that's being drawn? Look in the first two verses. "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." So while 1,000 years may seem like a long time, compared to the God that we serve, it is absolutely nothing. He has always been and he always will be. And you and I are but a speck on the strand of time. And it's that concept that we see in verse 12 that he's encouraging us to think about. Number our days. When you think about where we're at right now, December the 28th, we're at the end of 2014. How long has it been since we were at the end of 2013? Do you ever say, "Boy, days are just fleeting by"? You know, I've been here at Humble for 32 years. It sure doesn't seem like it. I've been married to my wife for over 50 years. And I can still remember our courtship and our marriage. It's gone in a moment. There are people that you've known who are gone. And next year, by the end of the year, there are people that you know who will not be here. Life is something you cannot hold on to. It's fleeting. And he says we need to think about that because it'll help us to have a heart of wisdom. Now, in the middle part of this psalm in verse 7, you'll notice it starts with the word for. Why is life so fleeting? Why is man's life so short? You'll note that he mentions down in verse 10, kind of a norm for human life at the time that this was written. And Moses was an exception to this. And the fact that he lived to be 120 years made him an exception. You'll note that it says, as for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, and soon it is gone, and we fly away. 80 years. That seems maybe to us like a long time, but when you expand your focus to the time of the existence of the earth and then further to the eternity of God, 80 years is just really nothing. How did it come to be that man is only living 70 or 80 years? You know, that wasn't always true. You can go back to Genesis chapter 5, and you have a genealogy that you find in Genesis chapter 5. And you see over and over again, for example, you can just pick a number of verses throughout here. For example, in verse 5, Adam lived 930 years and he died. Verse 6, Seth lived 912 years and he died. You go through, you see people living 800 and 900 years. Until you get to the, in verse 27, the days of Methuselah were 969 years, the oldest man recorded. All through that chapter. But turn over a few chapters to chapter 11. You'll see a totally different scenario. You have another genealogy. But when you get to chapter 11, look what happens. Verse 10. These are the records of the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and became the father of Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. Shem lived 500 years after he became the father of Arphaxad. So 600 years, still quite a long time, isn't it? But keep reading on down. And then you start getting down to, for example, verse 20. Reu lived 32 years, became the father of Serug. And Reu lived 207 years after he became the father of Serug and had other sons and daughters. And then you see men's lives beginning to continually to get less and less, to where by the time you get down to the end of the chapter, men are living 200-300 years. You get to the time of Abraham, and then, of course, Abraham lived to be 175. What happened from 900 to 175 at Abraham, and then by the time you get to Moses, down to about 70 or 80. What happened between chapter 5 and chapter 11? In chapter 6, Genesis chapter 6, you remember reading there, it says in verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thought of his heart was only evil continually. And then you remember what the Lord decided to do? To bring a flood upon the world, destroy human life, all human life upon the earth except for 8 people. Why did he do it? The answer is in chapter 6 and verse 5. Man had no regard for God and his responsibility to God. Living on a higher plane with a higher purpose was not a consideration. Man did what he wanted to, when he wanted to, and lived by his own law. God was angry with man and decided to destroy man from the earth. Evidently, there seems to be maybe some astronomical changes, possibly change to our atmosphere, environment. But whatever the case may be, for some reason after the flood, man's life began to decline. What's interesting in our psalm, whether he's specific or referring to that, I do not know. But it is interesting in our psalm that we're talking about the brevity of life. Teach us to number our days, and specifically mention 70 or 80 years, that this paragraph, starting in verse 7, talks about God's anger for man against man because of his sin. Look at verse 7. For we've been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we have been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days have declined in your fury. We have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if you to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. And soon it is gone, and we fly away. He comes back to the anger of God in verse 11. Who understands the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? I can't prove that he had reference to the flood. I do know this, the flood is recorded there for a purpose. And it is recorded to indicate God's anger with man when he does not consider God and does not order his life according to the will of God. And when you look around you and see how short men live, when you see all of the problems that man has in his short life upon the earth, that's worth contemplating. There's some connection in the brevity of life and the anger of God because of man's sin and failure to recognize this eternal Creator. And the psalmist, which is Moses, is saying, help us to think about that we can gain a heart of wisdom. Look over, if you will, at Psalm 39. Psalm 39. This particular psalm, you can see that this psalmist, is by David, was in a state of consternation. He wanted to say some things about the circumstances he saw, but he was hesitant because he was afraid he might say the wrong thing. He said in verse 1, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle. What is it that's causing David such problems that he realizes he may say some things that are out of order? Note the last line of that verse, while the wicked are in my presence. I was mute and silent. I refrained even from good, and my sorrow grew worse. So he said, I see these wicked people, and you'll see just a little bit later, that it seems like they prosper. They seem like there's no, and this is, several psalms indicate that, as if there's no punishment for their misdeeds. He said, but my sorrow grew worse, my heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned, then I spoke with my tongue. Lord, make me to know my end and what is the extent of my days. Let me know how transient I am. Is that not similar to Psalm 90? Let me know how transient I am. Behold, you've made my days as handbreadths, and my lifetime is nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. So you look at the wicked man, he amasses riches, he enjoys life, it looks like things aren't right. David said, we're just here for a little while. And if I can remember how transient man is, and even this man with all his wealth and all his pleasure, it's just for a little while. Then what? Then what? Are we willing to trade what's beyond for just that breath, for just that moment in time, which is our lifespan upon the earth? That's what these people do. And being aware of the fact that our lifetime is so very brief helps us to pursue the choices we make, the priorities we have with a degree of wisdom, realizing that indulging self and satisfying the natural pleasures and giving in to the passions that we may have is not worth what lies before. Psalm 90 is not the only passage that encourages us to consider the brevity of life. And it's an excellent time as we come to the end of this year. Tonight we're going to have a prayer meeting, the Lord willing. And Jeff has designed that prayer meeting not only to think about the year past, but to think about the year coming. And certainly he has on the sheet that he's going to hand out to the men who lead prayer some concepts along that very line. It's in perfect accord with these verses that we're looking at this morning. Look, if you will, at 1 Corinthians chapter 7. There's three main passages that I've chosen as far as the focus of this study on the brevity of life this morning. And I find it interesting that every one of these three passages, while the words are different, the phrases are different, the focus is the same, the brevity of life and the recognition of that, something that maybe we don't stop to think about. This is a chapter about marriage. And he said some things in this chapter that are difficult. For example, back up in verse 10, we were studying in a Bible class, if a woman leaves, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. What if this woman is only 20 years old? She's made a bad, bad choice. What if she lives to be 50? That's 30 more years of living alone. What if she lives to be 80? That's 60 more years of living alone. Man, that's a long time. No. When you number your days, it's like a flower that appears in the morning, gone at night. It's like a watch in the night. It's like yesterday. It's nothing in the span of eternity. And if this woman who's in that circumstance can get a hold of that, it'll help her cope with the difficulties that sin has gotten her into. So there's a number of things he says throughout the chapter. In fact, he advises them in verse 26 not even to marry because of the present distress. I don't know what the present distress was, but there was some kind of maybe pressure that would come upon them if they had a mate, that they would be relieved of if they didn't. You say, marriage is just too enjoyable. Surely he can't ask us not to marry to serve the Lord. That sounds very difficult. But if we have a view of the brevity of life, it will help with those kind of decisions. Look, if you will, as you get down to verse 29. This I say, brethren, the time has been shortened. Is this a reference to Genesis 6? The time has been shortened. What time? The time of man's life upon the earth has been shortened by God. It has been. From over 900 years till you get to Moses, about 1,500 years before Christ, saying man's life is 70 or 80 years. So what? So that. And then he mentions five things. All teaching the same lesson, but from five different perspectives. Look, so that from now on, those who have wives should be as those who have none. Is he saying if you're married, divorce, forget about your marital responsibilities? We know that's not the case. We know that from earlier in the chapter. That's not what he's saying. He's saying recognize, because life is so short, that these fleshly ties that you cherish so much are going to be dissolved. You're only going to be married for a little while. There is no marriage in heaven. Eternity is right around the corner. I don't know where it is for you and where it is for me. It may be tonight. It may be tomorrow. It may be 10 years from now. But if it's 10 years from now, and a broader perspective, it's nothing. He said, all fleshly ties are going to be dissolved, and don't make marriage the priority and focus of your decisions. He said, those who weep should be as those who do not weep. Earthly sorrows are just sorrows of this life. If we're Christians and we believe in Jesus Christ and we believe in the resurrection of the dead, we may weep while we're here. We may weep because of what sin has brought into our lives. We may weep because of physical pain. We may weep because of our loved ones who are in difficulties. But look beyond the sorrows of this life. There's coming a time there'll be no weeping. And if we can lift our focus and see that weeping is brief, at its longest, at 70 years, at 80 years, weeping is brief compared to the God of eternity and the eternity that lies before us. He said, those who rejoice should be as those who do not rejoice. And so, these precious times that we cherish, you know, people will sacrifice everything for a good time. People may ignore the laws of 1 Corinthians 7 about marriage and divorce so they can have fun and enjoy passions. But he said, do you understand that rejoicing is temporary? And those who rejoice should be as those who do not rejoice, realizing that life is so very, very brief. Those who buy as though they did not possess. We become so concerned with ownership of things. What are you going to own when you die? We're worried about our cars, and we're worried about our houses, we're worried about our land and our bank accounts and our 401. What are you going to own when you die? Nothing. Nothing. And so he said, those who buy should be as those who do not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. That is, use it with restraint. Use it with judgment. Use the blessings God given you, yes, but with wisdom. Now note the last line. For the form of this world is passing away. Isn't that the same message of Psalm 90? Isn't that the same concept of Psalm 39? We're transient. Understanding the transient nature of life helps me not to be full of consternation and ill will because of the wicked's prosperity for a very brief time. Understanding the transient nature of life helps me not to make all my life focus on and dependent upon the things that are upon this earth. I've got a higher purpose. I've got an eternal God in which I can take refuge. He never changes. And so it changes my whole focus about what are priorities, what means something to me, and how I should live every day of my life. We can see from Psalm 90, teach us to number our days, to contemplate the brevity of human life, so we can approach life with this kind of wisdom about those things that are so near and dear to us. Look over at James chapter 4. James chapter 4. Here's the third passage. Isn't it interesting? Not only in the Old Testament in Psalm 90 by the prophet Moses, but in 1 Corinthians by the apostle Paul, who indeed treasured this concept of the brevity of life because he labored in a body that had problems with it. He had some kind of thorn in the flesh. He had stripes on his body. But he talked about the transientness of this and the eternity that lies before him. And then later in another letter by another prophet, James, writing to brethren, once again, James brings these brethren back to the transient nature of life. James chapter 4, verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. I don't know what you're going to do in the next few days before the new year. Maybe nothing. Maybe you've planned your budget for the new year. Maybe you've planned your schedule for the new year. I don't know. But James says, look, when you start talking about the next year and what you're going to do, be careful. He said, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. Remember Psalm 90? Human life at its longest is but like yesterday. You do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. To live our life without an awareness of its brevity. To boast about living 20, 30, 40 years and here's what we're going to do and we've got our plans and we're going to have kids and we're going to build houses or we're going to retire and we're going to do this. And to live for that, if I understand this passage, if that becomes the focus and goal of our life, that is evil. I'm not saying you can't have a bank account. Can't prepare if God lets you live for retirement. We're not saying that. But every decision you make and every focus you have needs to be an awareness of the fact there's no guarantee. So live today under the hand of the eternal God, finding in Him your refuge, not in your money, not in your health, not in your job or your accomplishments. Look, he says in this last verse, therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do it and does not do it, to him it is sin. We've taken this verse out of context. And we've said, well, that means if you know something you ought to do, you better do it, because if you don't, it's sin. And that may be good advice. But that's not the right thing to do in the context. The right thing in the context is very specific. The right thing to do in the context is live with an awareness of the brevity of life. And he says to the one who knows the right thing to do, live with an awareness of the brevity of life. And he does not do that. To him it is sin. You don't know if you're going to contract cancer. You don't know if you're going to have a heart attack. You don't know if you're going to have an accident. You don't know what tomorrow holds. Even if you live to be 100, it's nothing. It's nothing. And live with an awareness of that and what the future holds, what lies beyond. So that, in 2 Corinthians, and in chapter 4, Paul is discussing his ministry. He said, as he discussed his ministry in verse 8, we're afflicted in every way, but not crushed. I can't read this and apply it to me. I have not suffered what Paul did. He talks about in this letter his life and his persecutions and how he was mistreated and how he was stoned and how he was beaten and how he was put in prison, how he was in a shipwreck, and just one thing after another after another. Here are people he worked with for a year and a half, and now there are those among them who are trying to undermine his character and indicate he's a hypocrite. He says, we're afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed. You ever perplexed, but not despairing? Persecuted? Maybe we really don't know much about that, but he did. But not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. Note, he had a higher purpose. Not his life, but that the life of Jesus would be manifest in the life that he lived and the work that he did. Now go down to verse 14. Knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and will present us with you. Verse 16. Therefore we do not lose heart. He knows that the body is going to be raised. This life is temporary. A resurrection is coming. Eternity lies beyond. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though our outer man is decaying, that's the body, that what you see in the mirror, it gets old, gets bent, gets wrinkled, gets gray. You have pain, suffering. Our outer man is decaying. Yet the inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary. Are we back to the transitory nature of time? Momentary. When Paul wrote this letter, I'm not sure how old he was. He wrote it probably in 57, 58 AD. He was probably converted somewhere around 33 to 36 AD. And by that time was already, the indications are, over 30. So by the time he wrote this letter, easily in his 50s or maybe 60s. So we're not talking about a young guy and a teenager. And yet he talks about all these things that he had endured since he became a Christian. He calls them momentary. How many years would you have to suffer beatings, stonings, being maligned, having to flee for your life, having to work day and night to try to survive. He did. He said, but it's momentary. He calls it light affliction. He said it's producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison, while we look not at the things which are seen. Did he not look at the things which are seen? Certainly he did. He talked about his thorn in the flesh. He talked about the stripes in his body. But that was not the priority of his thinking. Note that not but. He didn't dwell on, oh, look at my body and look at these stripes and look at this thorn in the flesh. He did pray that God would remove it, and God said no. And he went on with his life. We look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are what? Temporal. Temporal. Again, a time word. Paul's telling us why he did not get discouraged. It's the very concept of Psalm 90, Psalm 39, 1 Corinthians 7, James 4. It's temporal. It's just for a moment. But the things which are not seen are eternal. For we know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands. What's the contrast? To the word temporal in 4:18, what's the contrast in 5:1? Eternal. For indeed this house we groan, longing to be clothed with the dwelling from heaven, inasmuch as we, having put it on, will not be found naked. For indeed while we're in this tent, we groan, being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, so that what is mortal. What is mortal? It's the thing that this society focuses on. Your body. Exercise, food, looking good, cosmetics, your hair. Am I saying we shouldn't take care of our hair or exercise? No, it just should not be the focus of life. Your body is temporary. You are going to die. The passions of the body will soon pass away. It's mortal. And he said, verse 6, therefore, being always of good courage and knowing that while we're at home in the body, we're absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight. Look, that's another verse we sometimes draw out of the context. We use this verse to talk about walking by the Word of God instead of by human religion. We walk by faith and not by sight. That's not the context. He's saying my life is based on a principle of things I cannot see, but I believe in. Hope is the assurance. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for. The conviction of things not seen. That's the faith he's talking about. We walk by faith. There's an eternity beyond the veil of death. There's a heaven that awaits me out there. There's a better body, spiritual body, immortal body that I'll have in the resurrection. That's the faith that he's talking about. That every day he lived and breathed gave him the strength to continue. We walk by faith and not by sight. We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord. It's that kind of concept that will produce in the individual the attitude that you read about in verse 10 and 11. He said, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. Therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade men. Throughout 2 Corinthians, the first 7 chapters, he's talking about his ministry. He talks about the difficulties of his ministry. He talks about those who opposed his ministry and misrepresented his ministry. But he never quit serving. He never gave up. And here's the reason. He said, I'm going to appear before the judgment seat of Christ. And I'm going to have to give account for what I've done, whether I fulfill my ministry or not. knowing the fear of the Lord, I'm going to keep persuading men. Paul knew and lived a life with an awareness of the brevity of man's journey on this earth. He lived with a faith in the certainty of eternity and the resurrection. As we approach the end of this year, and if the good Lord is willing, get to see the new year, we'll make better decisions. We'll have better priorities if we live in view of the fact that we're only here for a little while. We lay up our treasures in heaven and strive to glorify the great God who is eternal. I don't know where you're at this morning in your relationship to God. Maybe you don't give it any thought. Worry about that tomorrow. Maybe there's jobs, family, fun. I don't care who you are. Tomorrow is eternity, and it's not very far away. Are you ready for that next step? Teach us to number our days that we may give our hearts to wisdom. If we can assist you in thinking about your life and the choices you need to make, then won't you come as together we stand and sing.